actually giving people the permission, the space, the tools, the practices to free up their imagination, their own sense, to create freedom internally, to not be controlled and hemmed in how they can perceive and imagine. I want to create that kind of bottom-up liberation.
Welcome to Entangled World, where we explore our interrelated existential, social, economic, ecological, and technological challenges, their underlying drivers, and how a more beautiful world might emerge. I'm your host, Nadia Shaukat Lupson. I'm a daughter of Pakistani Muslim immigrants, a mom, and an inter-systems thinker. Join me on a journey to discover what is uniquely and meaningfully ours to do at this pivotal moment in time, in service to the sacredness of life. Hello, my dear podcast listeners. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share that for the time being, I've decided to move to a monthly cadence of releasing new episodes, which I know in podcast land is like an eternity in between episodes. This podcast is a labor of love. I put a lot of time and energy into it, and I love doing it. And I also work full-time. I'm a mother of a young child, a partner, a daughter, an aunt. I wear many different hats in life. And producing this podcast on a biweekly basis has become really challenging to balance. I also have been craving a slower pace, more time in between episodes to reflect on and process the deep conversations I'm having with my guests. I hope this isn't too disappointing to you all, the wonderful listeners of this podcast. Please do reach out to me, send me a message on LinkedIn or an email, and let me know how you feel about a monthly release schedule. And if you haven't already listened to the first full episode of this podcast called What is the Meta Crisis, I highly recommend you go back and listen to that first. It's really a foundational episode that provides a lot of the grounding that is important for all the episodes that follow. And last note, we had a bit of an unstable internet connection during this conversation, so the audio and video quality is a bit different than usual. I hope it doesn't detract too much from the rich conversation we had, and I hope you're still able to enjoy the talk. Okay, on to today's episode. My guest today is Phoebe Tekel. Phoebe calls herself an imagination activist to describe a new kind of activist she sees emerging worldwide. Her interest in different ways of perceiving the world informed and was informed by her studies in neuroscience, cognitive science, molecular structures, and plant science. It was this interest in perception that eventually led her to found Moral Imaginations in 2020. In her work, she seeks to reimagine our relationship with ourselves, each other, the planet, and the future. Moral Imaginations works with municipalities across the UK and Europe to cultivate and train imagination activists and has trained 1,000 people in their methodology. In this episode, we explore the word imagination, what it means, and why it matters globally in this moment that we now find ourselves, in this time between worlds. We explore how shifts in perception change how we make sense of the world, and how we can actively expand our perception, which is critical if we want to play a role in creating radical systems change in light of the meta crisis. Phoebe emphasizes the seriousness of imagination as a tool for change, and she seeks to give people practices to leverage their imaginations to create freedom from within and to redefine the good life for themselves. I hope you enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it with a friend or two and subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the Entangled World Pod YouTube channel.
Hi, Phoebe. Thank you so much for joining me on the Entangled World podcast. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
It is such a pleasure to be here. We've been planning this podcast conversation for what feels like years, but it might have just been a year, but it's been on the cards for a while. I'm really excited to get stuck in.
Yeah. I'm glad we were finally able to make it work. So I'm excited to dive right in. And I wanted to start with my guests with just a little bit of getting to know them a bit and for the listeners. And so I know you've approached life like little experiments and you've charted your own path forward based on your passions. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about your personal story and how you've come to do the work that you do in the world.
Wow. It's funny, people often want to start with the personal story, and I'm always keen to talk about the work, but I know that, but they are so entangled, and obviously it's informed a lot of what I've gone on to do. So a little bit about me and my background is I'm half English, half Hungarian. My father is English, my mother is Hungarian, and the English side, it's a family of people concerned with the environment and ecology. And my grandfather was very, very interested in science and climate change. He was actually one of the people in the 70s who first started really sounding the alarm around climate change and global warming. And on my mother's side, it's a family of Hungarians. My mother was trained as a teacher. And so very different, two very, very different worlds. My Hungarian family is from a village on the border of Austria and Hungary called Fertőrákos. And I grew up speaking Hungarian. It was actually my first language. And then I learned English when I got sent to, British, like an English speaking nursery in London. I've been reflecting a lot on what it is about how I grew up, how that's impacted, how I've gone on to see the world. And I do think a major influence was growing up between Hungary, a small town called Győr. We'd go there in the summer holidays for 3 months, 2 or 3 months every single year, every single summer holiday. And I would speak pretty much purely Hungarian. I'd have Hungarian friends. I had my friends over there. We would spend, all of the time kind of roaming free by the river or in the forest, just totally unstructured time. There was Hungarian TV with like very limited channels and no internet. And so there was that. And then the other half of my life was in London, growing up in like the heart of the industrial growth paradigm and capitalism. And meanwhile, in Hungary, Hungary was in a Soviet country. And so from an early age, I was asking questions about why do things work in this way in Hungary? And why does it work in this way in England, and noticing kind of mimetic or these sort of meta level differences in the culture. Like one thing I picked up on pretty early on in life was that in Hungary there was no word that I was aware of for being posh. So there was in English, posh and your status and class, like that was actually pretty present with my different groups of friends. I had a really broad range of friends. I went to a state school in my primary school, and then I got into a very academic private school. And so I had friends both in the state system and private school system, and just felt like really present for me from an early age. And I noticed that in Hungary, it was very different. Like there wasn't class in the same way. And I noticed how, the clothes you wore or materialism was just much less important than within my experience of being in Hungary at the time. Obviously, mm-hmm. There's a big Western influence, but even things like there weren't Tesco's or Starbucks. And I remember thinking, like, it's just so weird. There are all these chains, in England. And I started learning about capitalism. And I had a Hungarian mother who, really involved. Like, I'm really grateful she really involved herself in my education. So when I was learning history, you know, and coming home with these questions around this like very, very British centric story of history, where it's like the Celts and the Romans and Britain and the war and like World War One. And my mom would just be like, okay, here's the other half of the history of why England is, you know, why this has ended up the way it is.
I'm curious what age you were when she started asking, or when she started talking about that. I'm just curious.
Good question. I think probably like secondary school. You know, I think it was in probably in like the kind of second or third year of secondary school. But like she's also always talked to me about politics, about history, because I trained as a scientist. Mm-hmm. And I went on to study science, and I had a natural passion for art, so for painting and drawing. So I was really, really deep in doing art, you know, from a really early age. And, you know, my house was like, my room was full of drawings and prints. And as I became a teenager, I got really into printmaking and really felt this call and passion for the artist's way. The artist's way of seeing the world. And I also noticed, like, when I would draw, I was interested in like the experience of drawing and painting and the closeness and intimacy it brought me into with life. Like, it felt like a very different way of experiencing the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, I think for my GCSEs, I did a project I painted a daffodil from, I was interested in plants, and I went on to study plant science at Cambridge, and I had a project where I took a daffodil. It's a really simple thing, but again, like it feels like a pretty formative memory. And I did a series of watercolors of a daffodil from bud to kind of, you know, flowering to dying, and like tried to get every single, I was like painting it every like 3 hours. So it was literally like a kind of stop motion photography. But I was interested in that relationship that you could get with the world and with that sense of enchantment and flow and like boundarylessness with nature and with the world through art. So that's some of like what's influenced me. And then science, you know, I was just really, really passionate about biology and science, like from a pretty, yeah, not actually, I'd say I was much more into the arts and like English and writing. Like I remember like when I was younger, when I was kind of age 10, we had to do a like, what do you want to be when you grow up exercise. And my thing was like a novelist, like writing novels. And before that, I wanted to be a dolphin trainer. But anyway, this is like, that's like deeper history. Then I discovered how cruel SeaWorld is. And I got very disillusioned with becoming a dolphin trainer, sadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you've started an organization called Moral Imaginations. And I'm curious to hear a bit about why you decided to focus your work in that direction. I think you could have moved in any direction. I know you've got a pretty wide range of interests and passions. You did some work in the education space. And so why has working on imagination been important for you? And how do you even think about that term?
Great question. And it feeds pretty nicely from what we were just talking about before in terms of, you know, some of those elements that I just talked about, like alternative histories, the attention paid to the world, that intimacy, the relationship with the natural world and perception. All of that, you know, has been brewing and bubbling in me since I was, a teenager. I went, you know, after graduating from Cambridge, I worked as a scientist for a while, but left after a couple of years, and have always felt this call to work in the realm of perception. As part of my degree, I studied, a third of the degree was neuroscience and cognitive science. A third of it was like cell development and, you know, the molecular structures of cells and genetics. And the last third was plant science and like plant development. And, you know, the neuroscience and cognitive science really, really impacted me in terms of the models around perception. And I went on to like really, really a lot around us in terms of the kind of electrical impulses in the brain. One of the things that really stands out to me from that time is that learning about how there is as much of an impulse that comes down from the brain when we're in sensory perception. It's not just information going in and up. There's just as much information that comes down from the brain cognitively to meet the information that comes in and actually influence that information as it enters your brain. So there's this kind of really interesting, like, information coming in, thinking and information coming down. There's obviously the limitations of, like, our sensory organs. It's also super interesting to me around especially sight and vision, and the fact that we have, you know, rods and cones in the cornea. I mean, now the retina, God, I don't want to, this was like over 10 years ago, so I might get this wrong. But the thing that really sticks with me around that was some of the kind of the sensitivities to how we see the world. So our eyes, like even kind of physically, the way our eyes and the kind of neuronal structures are structured are such that we are very good at, we bias towards edges. So in terms of thinking about how we experience the world and reductionism and, you know, linearity, like some of how humans, how we are structured as human beings in terms of how we experience and perceive the world, actually bias towards detecting edges and, you know, kind of objects. So without some of these biases, we'd go completely crazy because all the information would just be coming in and we'd be overwhelmed. And so, like, I've been thinking and researching and sort of inquiring around ways of perceiving the world since I was like 16, you know, and what, you know, that took me into science first because I was interested in understanding how this, you know, how it all works, like how we perceive, but also how the world is structured and how we learn about, like, you know, how life is structured and then how we structure a society and, you know, like fractals and decentralized systems and genetics, like, you know, just even how cells communicate to each other. Like that was a huge chunk of my degree too, like learning the language of cells communicating. So again, like communication, biomimetics, biomimicry patterns, the patterns of how we organize the world and also how we perceive. This is like the core of, this has been in me. I don't know, you know, this is kind of what has inherently driven me since I was really young. And I was interested in how we interrogate the world through a science lens and how we interrogate and experience and sense the world both through science and an artistic lens. And so moral imagination, it's funny, we were talking just before we started this conversation, we were talking about like the difficulty of naming things and, you know, like you could name something a thousand ways. And some of what led to this project and work has been the awareness that, you know, that was born in me around perception having an impact on what we then understand and what we go on to do. And, you know, that's the perception piece. So from an early, you know, let's say in like stage one of the development of the work I now am doing, and it's probably stage like 3 out of 100. And, you know, right now it's moral imaginations, and maybe there's another project or there's another iteration of this. But like, you know, I just see this as a much bigger inquiry of life. And as you know, I have been involved in consilience, which is all about sense making, and I was in education, and, you know, they all link. To me, it's all the same inquiry. And right now, moral imaginations is, I think it's an important contribution to the larger field of sense making and moral development and, you know, systems change. But there's plenty of kind of manifestations of this work that I sense will come and that are brewing in me. And I'm very, very passionate about education, you know, about how we choose to shape the perceptions and the cognitive development of our youngest, you know, of our future generations. It's one of the things that is most dear to my heart. And I think as more and more people around me, but, you know, in my cohort and generation have children, and as that becomes something alive in my consciousness, like I'm I'm super passionate about that. And I would not want to willingly send any of my kids to the education system that exists right now. So there's a backlog of projects. One of them is like creating a new school so that, you know, my kids don't need to, you know, and others' kids don't need to. So that's definitely on the things that I feel a desire to work on. So back to the stages. So stage one, perception. Perception changes what we sense, how we make sense of the world. Take the example of my mom and the history and the colonial British history told from the point of view of the British and the, you know, the Eastern European perspective, kind of rebellious perspective around the rest of the world coming in. That changes how I think about being British. That then changes how I choose to show up, what I do as an activist. You know, it's like perception is core of how we go on to design society. That's stage one. Stage two is like we can influence perception. We can work on our perception. We can, you know, mindfulness and Buddhism. Those are two, you know, two early influences on me when I was 21. I took a trip to Southeast Asia, spent 7 months in Thailand, Vietnam, Burma, Laos, and came across Buddhism and the Dharma. And, you know, I felt as if I'd like kind of had this sense of like indignation of like, how has nobody shared this with me? Like, how have I only just come across this at 21?
Yeah.
When there's an entire philosophy and like practical set of exercises and approaches like that are thousands of years old that have been developed over, like, you know, this long period of time. That is literally, how do you live well on earth? You know, what is your right life, right language? You know, how do you take care of your mind? How do you resist, you know, what in the Buddha Dharma they talk about samsara? To me, that's like colonial Western capitalism is literally like an embodiment of samsara. Yeah. So it was like, oh my gosh. You know, and my teacher, I mean, this is someone who's had a huge influence on me, very dear mentor and friend, Joanna Macy. You know, she talks about there's a word in Sanskrit, the kind of three evils, but that's not the right term for it. But, you know, you've got greed, delusion, and hatred, and how our current society and capitalist modernity is essentially a manifestation of these three thousands of year old, you know, that they already, it's like, and with it, you know, the Buddha already identified these three kind of concentrated sources of suffering. Mm-hmm. And she draws these comparisons between, say, like the delusion, you know, delusion and our current media system, or greed and like capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, and hatred, you know, that is all over, polarization, racism, all sorts of, you know, colonialism. So that had, you know, that when I discovered Buddhism, I was like, oh my gosh, so there are people who have designed an approach and like a methodology and in a way a curriculum to help like take care of your perception and actually take the reins of your perception. And so that's the kind of second stage. It's like we can influence the way we see and experience the world. And I think though, something I also noticed as I was growing up was that I had a natural tendency towards like enchantment and wonder. Like I just had this like natural kind of like, oh, the world is so amazing. You know, this curiosity of a biologist. It was really like, it was there in me. And I really wanted to
share
that.
Which everyone has as a child. Right?
Indeed.
It's there. Yeah. And it's our ways of living that often sort of dull that sense that we have.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. That totally. Although I would say some people, I think there are people who are naturally more inclined to like being more inner or being really interested in, you know, writing or, and I was really like, I just noticed that I was very drawn to the natural world and a sense of like amazement at the natural world. Maybe that's what I'm, more than just like wonder and enchantment, which as you say, and imagination as well is a human birthright and like a gift that all of us are born with. But I really felt like I could see that like this wasn't maybe in the adults around me as I was growing up. I was kind of perceiving like, oh, no, why do they not want this? Or like, what's missing? And I think I was passionate and excited about working out how to open that up for other people. And then, you know, reading Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception and William Blake and like understanding that these doors of perception can be opened. So that's the kind of second piece is like we can change the way we perceive to perceive the world differently. And we can actually take an active role in that. And if you don't take an active role, then you are already being indoctrinated and your perception is already being shaped, but just not by you. It's being shaped by the society around you, your teachers, politicians, you know, the systems that advertising, et cetera, et cetera. So like our perception is a, you know, if you think of it as like a block of marble, and as we grow up, it gets chiseled, you know, into like a Michelangelo. It's like something's being chiseled out from that how you're born with a kind of unbiased perception. And we can take a role in how we influence that. And then the last stage or piece is that, you know, one, we're in a context right now where it's never been more urgent to make pretty huge, drastic, radical systems change. You know, you talk about the meta crisis on this podcast. There are many different ways of describing the problem and the crisis. You know, I was just giving, I just came out of giving a talk at the New School for the Anthropocene. And, you know, we were talking about how we've just crossed the sixth planetary boundary. We're heading towards the 2 degrees of, you know, global temperature rise. 3 degrees means, you know, around 60% biodiversity loss. Like, listeners of this podcast don't need to hear the kind of fear factors or, you know, all of that kind.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. And even if you don't know the facts, I think most people sense that we're not, as a global society, moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Yes. I like that. It's very understated. We're not moving in the right direction. It's like we are literally on the brink of societal global collapse. Like, you know, in like complex systems, you don't know when, but there are already these shakes of the dying organism, like COVID, or, you know, 70% of Pakistan being underwater. Mm-hmm. Like, just, you know, this is not, you just can't pretend that this was the frequency with which these like extreme strange weather events, like, mm-hmm. oh, July is the hottest month, you know, of this year. And you're like, okay, but when was the last hottest month? Oh, last year. Oh, again, what about the year before? And then and then there's like, a, you know, 60 years before. So there is a quickening. So that's where the moral piece comes in. There is a moral, we have a moral duty to act, to change the system, to create a life-sustaining global society like that there just is. And so that, to me, I jump across from that. Like, we have a moral duty to also change the way we perceive in order to make those changes quicker and to, you know, perception leads to different action. And the imagination piece comes from, well, there's a couple of different reasons why I'm focusing on imagination. One is like Buddhism has already, you know, has got an amazing canon of like moral perception exercises. Like a lot of Buddhism meditation, mantras, like there's a lot already there. I became really interested in the power of imagination to shift perception through, you know, first the work of Joanna Macy. Like when I experienced her work in 2016, I was on a 10-day intensive and I saw the power of role play and the use of visioning and imagination to also bring people alive. Like, you know, one thing I'd been really pretty deep in mindfulness, like the mindfulness movement, taking mindfulness to schools and Buddhism and the Dharma. And I really felt like there was so much there. And as we look at like the wider population, it's not like Buddhism is everywhere. Like, it's still pretty niche. And I started to think about how do we get like perception change out to the world at scale? how could like kids take part in this, and schools, as well as governments, as you know, as well as like any person on the street, like any person who you come across. And imagination is something everybody has, and everybody has a relationship to in some way. It's kind of, you know, it's something that everybody knows. When you talk to someone about perception, it's like very abstract. It's hard to kind of, you know, it's also like not that accessible. So the imagination piece for me is about how do we create a way for people at scale to engage in this kind of perception change work? How do we make it fun and creative? And also, like, I am really convinced that there is an untapped potential in imagination as a practice, as a tool, and as a way to actually shift the way we see and interact. And I also think it's under attack from like algorithms, advertising, you know, technology addiction, less time daydreaming, more, you know, screen time, just less time for free time and kind of wondering and think, you know, that I think like the human thought and imagination is like slowly being like narrowed, and it's like a territory that is being slowly colonized. Mm-hmm. And imagination is almost like the immune system response to like forcing that all out. Like it's how we take an active role in building up that muscle to force out the unwanted influences of all of those things I just listed.
That's interesting. So okay, there's so many things I want to go back to in what you raised, but first I think what's coming to mind is, so I had Jonathan Rowson on the podcast recently, and he talked about three kind of different ways to think about our creative capacities, for lack of a better word. And he sort of said, if I'm remembering this correctly, you know, first there's imagination, or how we commonly think of imagination, which is our human faculty to bring into being or manifest things that are not already there or perceived by the senses, probably the sort of most typical way that most people think about imagination when you say that word. The second being the imaginary, right? The widest possible grasp of our whole predicament beyond ideology, psychology, the sort of social setting of the world. And then the third being the imaginal, or what might be called the sort of more spiritual realm, right? Like this is the place of dreams and archetypes and images. And I'm curious, because I'd love to talk a little bit more to paint a picture of some of the work that Moral Imaginations does. And so I'm curious to hear a little bit about how you hold that term and sort of what does that look like in the world? What does that, how are people engaging with that term in the ways that you and your organization are holding it and interacting in the world with it?
Mm-hmm. So firstly, those three different terms, I've heard also John Vivekie lay out those three as, you know, as three ways you can slice the imagination pie. Mm-hmm. And I think when I've heard John talk about, I think he especially focused on the difference between imagination and the imaginal, which again, like, you know, this isn't a science. It's not as if there's like a set, like this is the truth.
Yeah.
These are all like interesting ways of making sense of something that does have its underpinnings in cognitive science, but also consciousness, you know, similar to consciousness in a way, but slightly more graspable than consciousness, which can sometimes feel quite abstract and difficult to pin down, or different people have different definitions. But I think it was Henry Corbin who talked about the imaginal, you know, also James Hillman and, you know, others like William Blake and Jung, they've all been influences on how I think about imagination. And so this scholar that John was referencing, you know, talks about the imaginal, which I like, and it speaks to something I picked up on through the development of the practice. So I went to this whole topic really as a scientist, like I didn't research all the theory and then, you know, and write about it. I really started to experiment with this, run workshops, experiments. You know, we ran yes, hundreds of workshops, especially over COVID, like online, on Zoom, getting feedback, developing practice. Like that's been the core, and you know, some of the core part of this work has been actually developing methodologies and practice while also actually establishing a field of imagination within the meta-modern scene and systems change scene. Like that, you know, it previously when I got involved in this work, it was really imagination was in the creative, mm-hmm. in the realm of like the creative, like arts and crafts, you know, Ken Robinson, a little bit around creativity and his amazing work around schools and how we're killing creativity in schools. But a lot of the work has been getting out this, you know, popularizing the view, but also like kind of making a case for it using research and explaining the theory of why we need to actually focus on imagination as a practice in order to change the world. Because as I say, like previously it was seen as imagination is like great for creativity and daydreaming. And what moral imaginations has done, you know, obviously like alongside many others, it's not like it's only us, but I think that's been our big focus has been to establish imagination practice as something that could lead to systems change. And like be taken seriously. You know, mm-hmm. we talk a lot about how imagination is serious, and then the moral imagination piece just makes it really clear that this is not like creative imagination. This is about imagination with that seriousness and that moral duty to imagine differently. To jump back to the imaginal imagination difference, though, really briefly, this is really helpful for just to outline this in order to explain some of our work. You can think of the imaginal as being like the bringing of a different way of perceiving into like an eyes open scenario, like a role play. So like if I, you know, if I put on a cloak and, you know, and grab a stick and I say like, I'm, you know, Darth Vader, you know, I'm from Star Wars. Like, obviously you can see that it's I'm not Darth Vader, but because of these props and like because of the imagination and the agreement kind of imagination contract we enter together, it's like, I'm inviting you to see me in a certain way. I'm using my imagination. And then I like channel that into how I'm being and doing, mm-hmm. you know, like method acting. So that's mm-hmm. like, in the imaginal, we're bringing like imaginal practice into this realm and into what we're doing, an activity we're engaging in together. Then the imagination, you could think of as like eyes closed, visioning, like generating images of things that either aren't there in the present or in the future. And so those are like, I think that's an important kind of distinction to make. And then obviously the imaginaries are the products of imagination or collectively like a social imagination. I think that's also where if I've understood correctly, it's where Perspectiva has really focused as well, and around mm-hmm. the social imaginaries, and that also links a lot with deep narratives and myths, which I also find really, really interesting and are also a really important part of understanding how we've got into the mess we're in now and how we get our way out, is like these cultural narratives, deep narratives, social imaginaries in terms of what is possible, what is a good life, you know, what does it mean to be successful? These are kind of cultural imaginaries that we hold as a society. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of like why we're focusing on this, I mean, and what that looks like in practice, I have, you know, moral imaginations has focused mainly on bringing imagination practice. But we define the practice as moral imagination because it's not any kind of imagination. Imagination can lead to weapons, you know, mm-hmm. the creation of weapons, the creation of wars, the creation of nation states. When you say imagination, it doesn't specify what kind of imagination we're talking about. You can have mm-hmm. capitalist colonial imagination. So we're trying to make a case for this, as I talked about before, a kind of a positive correcting force to the imaginations and imaginaries that are creating our society currently. there, you could call this any different, you know, some people talk about social imagination, some people talk about kind of collective imagination, but you could have collective imagination, you know, in Google. Google is full of collective imagination, or the CIA has got plenty of collective imagination. So what we're asking for is imagination with different premises at the core. And that's where this practice that I've developed called moral imagination sits. It's about changing the premises, changing the actual like codes by which we perceive the world. Some of those being, you know, moving from seeing humans as separate from nature, or seeing the world as a dead, soulless, unsacred, you know, unsacred universe. And Ian McGilchrist talks really well about this in his book, The Matter with Things. You know, a lot of Ian's work resonates really deeply. And we recorded a great conversation with Perspectiva a couple months ago, or last year, which I recommend looking at if you're interested in that whole area of thinking around perception and premises and the matter with the way we have trained our perception in the Western, you know, Western world, modernity. So moral imagination, as I said, so first there's a shifting of premises, and like there's a whole list of these mindset shifts that I've like outlined. You can look those up online, and I'm also currently writing a big piece about them. So these are some core premises which we need to shift. And then imagination from that place of a shifted premise of how we see the world, and, you know, the epistemology, the ontology, the cosmology, we shift that. And then we imagine from that place, that creates a very different future, creates very different systems. Mm-hmm. So that's the core.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, those amongst us who might consider ourselves somewhat awake beings and, you know, sort of aware of what's happening in the world and have some sort of understanding of how things are entangled and interconnected, we're still part of systems that reflect this industrialized, siloed ways of thinking. So our perception is inevitably influenced and somewhat limited, I think, by those ways of being in the world. And so and this is a question I've been sort of wrestling with a bit, which is, you know, is it possible for us to truly imagine a world completely different from what exists today? Do we risk replicating our past ways of being under a sort of feel-good banner of imagination? Like, how do we tackle the fact that we have these ingrained beliefs and ingrained values that have developed and lived and grown inside of us? And there's no way to not bring those things, even if we're actively trying to shift them. So I'm curious as to sort of how you're thinking about that.
I think, like, firstly, there is absolutely a risk. I mean, I guess the risk, it's like, to me, I see that as a risk of just more the same. So at least it's not like worse. So yeah, it's a risk, but it's like, okay, the risk of a lot of like the work around, you know, around kind of imagining, but nothing actually changing. It's like, okay, yeah. So we're still stuck in what I call the fish tank. So I talk about this metaphor of a fish tank to help just as a shorthand for like the reality that we're in. So I just like really briefly, it's like people can imagine that they're a goldfish in the fish tank. And, you know, I ask them to think about, like, you're born in the fish tank and you realize that there's inequality and you want to change things and that things aren't, you know, as you hope for them to be. And so you start protesting and you say, like, another fish tank is possible. You've got your, like, little goldfish placard and you stop going to goldfish school and you glue yourself to the side of the fish tank and you're, like, you know, demanding change to make the fish tank better. And actually, you know, that is a metaphor for like the green economy, conscious capitalism, design thinking 2.0, you know, all these things, like actually a lot of like traditional activism as well. It's like just demanding for better conditions in the fish tank, but there's a failure to actually present like an alternative. So like that to me connects to what you, to your question. It's like we could just imagine a new fish tank. And in the new fish tank, there's a better bubble machine and there's a better, you know, there's a better water filtration system and there's more fish food for all fish. And yet we're still in the fish tank. And that is what this entire project is about. Is how do we actually get out of the fish tank and into the vast and endless sea, which kind of calls on, refers to their famous quote. I always find it really hard to pronounce his name. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the French, this quote by this a French man who said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And so like this is really the call and the yearning, you know, the thing that is motivating this work is actually how do we use imagination to get out of the fish tank and reach the sea. And so that means that we don't just reimagine things from the confines of capitalist modernity programming. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's not even like, yeah, there are brilliant people, colleagues in the space who are working around like post-capitalism as a frame for what we're working towards. And I see a lot of power and strength in that. And I also see that actually a lot of these patterns go much deeper into the past, like pre-capitalist, like industrial, scientific, like reductionist, like colonial ways of thinking that are not only about capitalism and trying to find a term for that fish tank thinking. You know, Joanna Macy talks about the industrial growth society because, you know, industrial growth can underpin communism. Like it's not just capitalism.
Yeah.
Capitalism that's the problem. Like, you know, as I go back to my childhood, seeing these different societies, like there were issues with both. So, you know, these myths like humans are competitive and selfish do really underpin, you know, neoliberal capitalism, like this very special breed, like the hyper resistant virus that has been mutated in the 1970s with Reagan. You know, there's a lot that I think there's a kind of concentration of a lot of these codes, programs, premises that have crystallized in neoliberal capitalism.
Yeah. We actually see a lot more cooperative, you know, in nature, we see a lot more cooperation. We see competition as well, but it's not the only sort of mode or way of being, as many of us have been brainwashed to think about.
Exactly. And I'm actually writing an essay on that right now, because it's like going even deeper than that. Like there's a deeper story around how we came to framing evolution as, you know, as something that is like competitive in nature. And yeah, so I'm thinking a lot about that right now. But I was really influenced by Lynn Margulis when I was at Cambridge as a biologist, and she's still one of my heroine scientists. And, you know, she published her paper about endosymbiosis like 15 times, and it was rejected. She tried to publish it, like it was rejected 15 times. And finally, you know, she got it published. And you know, now it's like taught in every curriculum around the world. I mean, incredible. And that at the core is about how every single cell in our body is built out of a mosaic of, you know, different organisms and life. And like, that was one of the first things when I was still working in the lab in Imperial College London. I was working around symbiosis of bacteria and algae and doing all this reading about symbiosis. And when I revisited like secondary school lessons around endosymbiosis, something that really struck me was like, here is a scientific fact that each of our cells has relics of bacteria that are now our mitochondria. Like it's in our cellular makeup that we are tapestries and mosaics, and that even calling ourselves human is just a human construct. Like what does it mean to be a human species? Like we are just, you know, to get into the kind of Buddhist or Taoist or, you know, hippie world, it's like we are flows of energy and of life and different life, and the human construct is the one that's put on this, you know, arbitrary divisions and separations and things. So that
Nora Bateson, you know, talks about where's the edge of us. I like the question that she asked, right, which is explores like where's the edge of us of,
is it the school, is it the
it our food, is it the relationships we have with people? Where, you know, where is that, right? And you think about things like our gut microbiome, which is just alive and teeming with many other little individuals. And
exactly. Yeah, the microbiome has almost been like my mantra. It's like called, referred to as like bacteria girl. So it was like, I was just kind of obsessed with this idea that we're, you know, I think the figure back when I was quoting it in like my early 20s was more like 90% bacterial cells, 10% human cells. Now we know it's more like 40, 60. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this was one of the things that pretty early on I've really like held on to and then translated into an imagination practice, the symbiosis meditation. And that was like one of the early exercises that I created, like coming from the science, giving people a lived and experiential embodied sense of blurring the boundaries between human and non-human and the fact that we're made up of bacteria and that our microbiomes are, you know, that they influence our moods and thinking and they're not human. I mean,
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier in the conversation about changing perception at scale. So this word at scale.
Let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. And the reason I think I'm going back to it is that I think there are many things in the world that we often ruin by trying to think, oh, how do we do this at scale? And yet I acknowledge the balance between the reality of the situation that we're in, which is all of the crises that we talked about early on. And so I'm just curious, when you think about this idea of taking something and bringing it to scale, how do you kind of balance those two dichotomies?
So I think this is a great example of like the language trap. The word scale has been co-opted by capitalist modernity to mean a certain thing. And when I say scale,
make money.
I think, or top down. Yeah, make money, create a model and replicate the model in a factory and scale it so that it's the same everywhere. It's like, it's the, you know, the cookie cutter model of scale. When I say scale, I'm not thinking I need to build up a global mega corporation moral imaginations that like gets its exercises out to every single institution and must, you know, like, no, absolutely not. What I'm thinking is like, just like in nature, things scale through sporulating, through, you know, like a dandelion scales, like pollinating, allowing something to be accessible, allowing it to travel, to grow, to spread. That's also scaling. Like, it's just that it's, you know, nature's version.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's frustrating because it's like, yeah, of course, the word scale has been co-opted and it means a certain thing. But yeah, I don't mean like, let's create a water bottle that, you know, that gets fabricated in a factory and sent around the world to, and is replicated exactly the same and controlled. But, and so like, let's take this from many different directions. One thing that does feel really important to me is that the work that I create and do is accessible, that maybe there is the deep theoretical, you know, complexity science version. So the diehard kind of meta-modern complexity fans, like people who are like hungry for that.
The nerds
material.
Like
the nerds, I mean, I love the nerds. So like, I want to create that kind of work, but I also want to create work that people who don't have the time, the interest, the, you know, the educational, like they haven't had the privilege of the degrees in complexity science and don't have those resources, that they can access this work. And the final piece around scale that is really important to me is that this is not about programming people's perception at scale. This is not about Phoebe and moral imaginations and, you know, this ideology telling you how you should imagine or what is right and wrong. Because this word moral also really, it creates a lovely trip up for people and it's kind of like, oh, you know, you're talking about right and wrong and who are you to decide? It's like, again, like, and this is why I'm doing a lot of writing right now, because I need to basically break down and lay out all of these pieces, all the pieces that are, you know, that have been gathered over the last 15 years that have kind of brewed into this thing. You know, moral, what I'm interested in there is actually the opposite of a hierarchical morality system, you know, like the church, like the kind of top down, right or wrong, moralistic, you're going to hell, you're going to heaven. And actually giving people the permission, the space, the tools, the practices to free up their imagination, their own sense, to create freedom internally, to not be controlled and hemmed in how they can perceive and imagine. I want to create that kind of bottom up liberation, or help catalyze that kind of liberation internally, which also allows people to sense into what is right and wrong for them, for a good life, to actually redefine what that means, and also to connect to what I believe is a core human inherent sense of what is sacred and what needs to be protected, and what is like actually defiling the sacred, like when you destroy rainforests at scale, when you use lawnmowers to destroy, you know, wildflowers and insects, like reconnect. But, you know, again, there is no right and wrong. Maybe for some people, it's, you know, it looks different to others, but actually creating, helping people build their own muscle of what feels like what they need to work towards, and reconnecting mm-hmm. them to life and themselves and others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you've reflected on your work and its perceivable outcomes, how have your learnings sort of influenced your ideas of how change happens? So for example, you know, I know you've done some work in Camden, working with the city there, and I'm just curious how your work over the last few years has really shaped what you see in terms of how concrete change actually happens in the world.
Interesting, like concrete change, right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. Even that terminology. As I said it, I was like, oh, I don't like that word. Why am I using that word?
There you are again. It's inside all of us. Right. Like, it's right. Like, you know, and it's like the scale and the, ooh, like the concrete change is, you know, I get that a lot from people. They're like, okay, but what actually is, you know,
yeah,
where are the metrics,
right? What's the result? Yeah, no, I didn't mean that. I meant more perception of how things emerge, how things change, how transformation happens, and mm-hmm. nobody has an answer to these questions, obviously.
No, but completely. I mean, yeah. I think what I have learned about change, you know, obviously we've got our project, the projects like the Camden project and the project we did around creating an interspecies, like multi-species democracy, multi-species governance practices with DEFRA and Policy Lab. I actually think I've learned more about change through what I've seen in like the surrounding ecosystem. Because what I see is actually like, just the traveling of means and ideas and practices, and how like thing, like it's totally nonlinear and it ripples, and you'll see, you know, as I said around imagination, like 4 or 5 years ago, nobody was talking about imagination. Suddenly it's like there are people who are suddenly talking, like not suddenly, but like Ian McGilchrist is obviously writing his books for the last 10 years and published, you know, really recently. And he's got his chapter around imagination, and his work is like really coming into being an influence right now. So they're like, what I've seen is there are all of these different people who are coming towards a topic like perception or the meta crisis or imagination or systems change. And you've got kind of the warm data work and like how that influences, you know, has influenced so many, and the UN, you know, UNDP labs and Club of Rome, and then you've got this kind of meta-modernism kind of wave, you know, then the work around, yeah, just that, what am I saying here? What I've seen is that change is nonlinear. The things you think will lead to lots of change often don't. a talk that you can get, you know, you give a talk and it suddenly gets like tens of thousands of views and people, you know, or a course, like I ran a course a couple of years ago called Tools for a Generative Renaissance. And I did that. I did that as like a side thing, like a hobby with a friend, somebody else from the space. And we just put on this course during the pandemic and it just felt like, oh yeah, this is a cool, a nice, a fun thing to do. Somebody had approached us with a bit of funding. So do you want to create a course around regeneration? Cool. Yes. So we put together this 8-week curriculum. Just felt like really a non-important thing. The number of people that have come back to me and said, that course literally changed the course of what I went on to do. I left my job. You know, somebody who said they'd left their job like in government and gone and started a permaculture farm, and another person's like gone into regenerative design, and somebody, you know, and it's like you just don't know what's going to touch people and change people, and when people are ready, you know, also to take away the hubris and the kind of self-importance of like any one of us is changing anyone else, like that my course changed that person. No, they were ready. They'd heard a bunch of different things. They felt attracted to the course because of all the other people and things they'd read and their histories and their grandmothers and, you know, the stars and their horoscope that month. Like, you know, that led them to take the course, and it was just the right time and the right moment. And so what I think I've learned about change is like, you do not know, you never know where it's, you know, where it's going to happen, how you're going to touch people. And the important thing is just to keep on, you know, showing up, doing the work, you know, the chop water, carry wood, no, chop wood, carry water, chop water and carry wood. That's what I think about change. I mean, there's some truth in that, because you do things, you also like make mistakes.
Yeah.
And sometimes that unlocks something for people. So I'm sorry if that, I'm not trying to get out
of the question.
No, that is the truth.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, you can get stuck in the worry about the unintended consequences of your work. Like, what if what I'm doing actually results in something becoming worse? And I can't control that either. But there's stressful. Also, yeah, it's very stressful. And I think I was in that space for a while, really kind of struggling with what I was meant to do here in this world. And but I also think that when you really kind of get that we are not in control, we don't get to say what change happens through our work. When you really get that, there's also a little bit of a, I don't know, for me, it felt a little bit of a weight lifting to say, it's not all on me. It's not, I don't have full, you know, things are going to go the way they're going to go. And I'm going to bring my best intention and my open heart and be driven by love, and where things go, they go.
Yeah, and it really unburdens you as well, that perspective. And it's just more, you know, to walk the talk of all of the things we've talked about. Like, I am not Phoebe. I'm not even human. I am a flow of, you know, my ancestors, my mom, my dad, my, you know, that experience in childhood, the bacteria in my gut, the food I ate. Yeah, it's a constant negotiation between that cosmic view and then the necessary kind of individualistic way of being to be able to kind of operate in the world where you're trying to make change. I find that a really interesting spectrum to be navigating and negotiating between. But it does lighten the load when you realize you don't know how things are going to work. I think I root myself cross between like strategy and a theory of change, and then like, holding it extremely lightly and taking full attention to intuition and cosmic directions, you know, and if there's a, you know, and so there's a whole version of the strategic story that I could tell from a cosmological mythopoetic perspective, which is like, I learned the term moral imagination from Joanne Macy. Can't explain it. When I heard that term, it just moved me, and it called me, and I feel like I've been invited to steward this work into the world. And I can explain all of that as we have through a sequence of events, and like it's just happened, and this is what has been, you know, calling me, and it wants to be in the world. And so I wonder when that work will be done.
Beautiful.
So yeah,
I want to be conscious of our time because I know you have a train to catch.
Always.
So,
Andrea, yeah, this was amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, just to close, I wanted to ask you, who would you like to platform to come onto the podcast?
Yes. And I did have a think about this before, and there are so many amazing people in the space. And, you know, as you and I talked about before, there's a real wealth of a certain archetype of person in the space. And there's a noticeable lack of younger female people of color. And so I'd love to platform some of those folks from my ecosystem who have really influenced me and whose work I think is incredible and impeccable. One of those people is Pat McCabe, who is a Diné mother, grandmother, activist, artist, writer, ceremonial leader, and yeah, voice for global peace. And I met her at Schumacher College. She was teaching a course with Charles Eisenstein and bringing her perspective on the hoop of life and being all part of the hoop of life, and also the relationship between the masculine and feminine. She's incredible. Mm-hmm. Another brilliant thinker, artist, dancer, educator, trickster, Black Latine artist, her name's Bronte Velez. And I met her also through Joanna Macy, and they're based in Northern California. They're setting up a school, which I forget the name of it, but it's they're setting up a school, and they work in this space around kind of feminist placemaking and abolitionist theology, environmental regeneration, death doulaship, and they run an organization called From Lead to Life. So taking guns and melting them down into metal that is then used to create shovels to fuel like a permaculture movement. So like really beautiful work. And lastly, amazing. I think Vanessa Andreotti is somebody who comes to mind who I don't think you've had on the podcast before. And she's the author of Hospicing Modernity. And she's the director, I think, of the Peter Wall Institute. Anyway, she's at the University of Victoria. And yeah, this book, Hospicing Modernity, has really rippled out and influenced so many and really prepared people for, yeah, to think in this way of actually needing to end the chapter that we're in and decolonize and shift perception. So I see her work as incredibly important in the space. And there's many more, but I think you said amazing. Two or three.
This is amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for this beautiful list. Her book has been on my reading list for a long time, and it's getting pushed down.
Fantastic piece of work.
Yeah. Awesome.
Nice. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
If you liked the episode and want to hear more conversations where we explore how a more beautiful world might emerge, subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast app or the Entangled World Pod YouTube channel. If you loved it, support the project at patreon.com/entangledworld. Thank you for listening and for coming on this journey together.